From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1970 in the Rochester City School District. After years of debate, the district attempted to implement a busing program as a way to reduce segregation in schools. Rochester is like many American cities, with a history of racism and discrimination, particularly in school settings. The Democrat and Chronicle's Justin Murphy reports that as far back as 1841, the Monroe County School Board was asking the state education commissioner whether it must allow black children into its common schools. The commissioner at the time responded that if schools allow black students, white children will stop attending, and therefore segregation is justified. But by the 1970s, there was a growing national debate about how to achieve integration and whether, for example, busing was an effective tool. In Rochester, the efforts didn't seem to last long, and white families fled to the suburbs. Then came the Supreme Court decision in the case of Milliken v. Bradley. The court was asked whether desegregation in Detroit was limited to city boundaries. Essentially, as Murphy reports, the court was asked whether integration initiatives could cross school district boundaries, and the court said no. In his dissent, Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote, quote, "In the short run, it may seem to be the easier course to allow our great metropolitan areas to be divided up in each into two cities, one white, the other black. But it is a course I predict our people will ultimately regret," end quote. In 2019, cities like Rochester remain deeply segregated, and presidential contenders are reexamining the policies that led to this segregation. Former Vice President Joe Biden has defended his past opposition to busing, for example. Well, this hour, a conversation about what solutions could have prevented segregation and what tools might work in the future. Our guests this hour include Paul Hippolyte, a political strategist. Paul, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Bill Calla, former superintendent of the Rochester City School District, the Fairport Central School District, co-founder of Joining Hearts and Hands. Bill, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us is Eamon Scanlon, an education and policy analyst for the Children's Agenda. Eamon, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
I want to listen to the exchange at the debate last week between former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris regarding the issue of busing, which really is more about integration and desegregation efforts. Let's listen.
Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America? Then,
no,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act. That's why we need to pass the ERA, because there are moments in history where states fail to preserve the civil rights of all people.
I have supported the ERA from the very beginning when I ran for the—
Vice President Biden, 30 seconds, because I want to bring other people into this.
I supported the ERA from the very beginning. I'm the guy that extended the Voting Rights Act for 25 years. We got to the place where we got 98 out of 98 votes in the United States Senate doing it. I've also argued very strongly that we, in fact, deal with the notion of denying people access to the ballot box. I agree that everybody, once they, in fact, they should. Anyway, my time's up. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Vice President.
All right. That's from last week's debate hosted by MSNBC. Paul, I'll start with you. What do you make of that?
It was a colossal mistake by Joe Biden. But even before we get into the politics around that, I just kind of want to, if I'm allowed to, reframe this a little bit.
Please,
so busing started, I mean, busing just as a term is a failure. So it turned out to be a political code word. So Dartmouth history professor Matthew Delmont talked a lot about this. He's done a lot of research on busing and segregation, and we're not actually talking about busing. It was used as it was used pejoratively to say, well, look, you have all these minority kids coming into your district, or we have thousands or millions of people coming in. I think the first time that we saw the term used was in the 1950s in New York City. But really what we're talking about is desegregation and integration into schools.
Busing was a scare word.
Absolutely. And so I'm a little hesitant to even frame the conversation around busing, because that's not, it's going to, it's going to invoke the wrong kind of images in people's heads.
I think more than fair. And when it comes to the question of what policies could be effective at integration, you know, I think there's been some confusion over what people even thought at the time. Certainly, Republicans and Democrats, if you asked them in polls in the 1970s, do you want, quote, busing? They said no. But if you asked African Americans in polls, the questions that I saw framed in the polls I saw, Paul, essentially said, of these following menu of possible options for integration, what do you prefer? Now, busing was there at like 9%. And now you've got some journalists saying, well, black families didn't want it either. I don't know that that's true. I think it was just a way of saying, are there better ways to achieve desegregation? As opposed to just saying, well, busing was a bad idea. Because that's kind of what the Biden campaign is now saying. Well, look, nobody wanted this, not even African-American families. What do you make of his response to his own history? And do you think it matters right now, Paul?
It matters. It matters how we talk about the issue. It matters how we move forward on the issue. Unfortunately, the policies that we're trying to implement around integration really lasted only a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I believe the research shows that roughly around 1988 was the height of it. And as of now, we're back to the same levels of desegregation. I believe this year actually marks the 65th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Ed, and we are back to levels of segregation. Back to levels of segregation that were similar to that time, and so we are back at a point where there needs to be a conversation as to how we're going to move forward. I know it's complicated, but the other part is it's not just about racial integration anymore, but you're also talking about economic integration, mm-hmm. Where you have a number of black and brown families that are middle class or wealthy that have also segregated into their own communities or into white communities, into the suburbs. And so the issue is a lot more complicated than I think it was back in the 60s.
Okay. Bill Keller, what did you make of what you heard last week and the way this issue has sort of reemerged?
Well, I agree with Paul. I agree with Paul because the busing is a lightning rod. It's a lightning rod term. I think we do have to look at, you know, what are the ways that we are.
And I'll ask you even a little bit closer.
Okay.
I'm saying.
Yeah, go ahead. I think we have to look at, what are the ways that we're going to try to integrate schools, and obviously busing is one tool in order to get there. But there are others. All of them take political will, and I think the economic issues are incredibly important. You could look at our history with redlining and how that has affected the issue, and how has it affected integration, and how long it has taken to try to ameliorate that situation. And there are still issues with that when it comes to lending, mortgages, and so on. So we need political will. And I think if you look at that debate, I think it really was an exemplar of the lack of political will. The question was asked, what do you think of what your position was? What do you think today of what your position was then? And it was nothing but defensiveness. I would hope that there would be an evolution of thought on that idea in 2019. And apparently there hasn't. So it's an issue. I'm very glad that it happened, and that it's in the spotlight. And I am a bit surprised that it has the legs that it has right now. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, and I'll just follow up that point, Bill. Journalistically, I'll defend the decision we're making to talk about it here on this program and to put the spotlight on it, because the Biden campaign keeps saying since last week's debate, we cannot be mired in the past. We cannot be mired in the past. But this is a problem that is potentially even worse today, but it is not gone. And so to not, number one, examine where we were in the past and how we got to 2019, and then to ask if there are different or better options into the future, all of that to me says it is connected. I don't think it is inconsistent. In fact, I think it should be required that we examine those positions.
We are in a much worse place today than we were in the 60s. If we were to look at the Rochester City schools in the 60s and look at the economic and racial makeup back in the 60s and compare them to today, we would be looking, those were the good old days. And those were the days when we had riots. But the ratio, we would give a fortune to have that economic and racial mix in our schools today. And we don't. It's much worse.
Eamon, what do you make of this?
It's good that the issue came up in the context of the debates. I don't know if it'll continue. And there's a question, is this just a cheap political point, or are we actually having a real conversation about this? And I don't know if there's the stomach for that. Recently, in the past few years, there was the controversy in Spencerport over the urban-suburban program. And if we frame that locally, there's been conversations about going to a countywide school system. How do we deal with the racial and economic isolation of the city school district? And not a lot of people have clear answers because of the political will question. It would be a huge lift to get everybody on board to give up some of the power that the wealthy suburbs have ensconed themselves in. And we should think of it both as a race issue and an economic issue. And we can't, as Paul said, it's complicated. It's even more complicated than that. But I would say if you had to think about two lenses, you have to think about race, you have to think about economic inequality, and you also have to think about how those two are related. And even if we integrate schools, are we tackling poverty? Are we tackling some of the drivers that pull our society apart? So it's good that it came up, but I'm wary of the fact that this is a cheap political point and not a real reframing of a conversation. So I think it would take us as a community to really raise these issues and be a little bit bolder.
All right. So, well, let's build on that. And it's interesting, you're linking the fear, the pejoratives, the scare tactics that Paul is kind of taking us through throughout history that led to this term busing as a scare word, in the same way that my mind now, because of what Eamon just said, takes me to 2003 in the county executive race with the Pac-Man ad that Steve Manaert created when Maggie Brooks ran against Bill Johnson, this idea that the city was going to eat up the suburbs, that we were going to have metro government, and you know what that means. All the bad things in the city are coming for you in the suburbs, which had a lot of undercurrent of race. It's the same kind of scare concern. So we haven't, well, I mean, I would say I haven't figured it out. I don't know that some people think there is something to figure out. I mean, this has been the status quo in most of white America for a long time. So let's try to push it forward. I'll start with you, Eamon. When we look at where we are now, as Bill Callahan just told us, even more, and by the way, let me just throw a couple numbers out there. Again, I'm copying off of Justin Murphy's reporting for the Democrat and Chronicle. In 1963, the Rochester City School District had more than 75% of its students were white, but the numbers were changing. Today, less than 10% are white. And it's been almost a total flip on its head, we've seen from the 50s. But by the middle to late 60s, yeah, it was much more sort of a mix of economic class and diversity, racial diversity, than there is today. It's really amazing when you see that in 50-plus years. So going forward, are there government policies or are there personal choices? I'm sure it's a mix, but what's in the toolkit? What can actually work here, Eamon?
So obviously the most expensive but the most permanent is housing policy. It's, do you have access to affordable housing in every community? That is the biggest barrier to a kid enrolling in, you know, Pittsford or Brighton, is that the housing stock there is just really expensive. And it's not a coincidence that where we have the most diversity in the suburbs, we have the most affordable housing and apartments that you can get into, like Rush Henrietta, Chi Lai, East Irondequoit, Greece. It's just more affordable. And, you know, I do a lot of work with parents in the city school district, and they'll tell me, you know, a mother who is struggling with her son who has Down syndrome and wants to get him access to better programs, but she says, you know, I can't buy a house in the suburbs. It would cost twice as much as my house is now, right, for the same space. So there's a huge economic hurdle, but that's very expensive. So that's one more permanent solution. I think the county model should be something we should seriously consider. But if we go to a county model, it doesn't mean that everything's going to rejigger and we're going to have equality. Like, you need to put some really strong measures in place to ensure equity within that system, because you could have a county system and still have huge pockets of inequality.
A county system of schools?
Yes.
Of schools. So kind of like Wake County, North Carolina, a countywide school district.
Yes.
Okay. Bill Callahan's ready to...
Right. Yep. But of course, let's make sure we understand what Wake County is. Okay. Wake County is not just a county school system. There's also the major component of that is that no school will have more than 40% children of poverty. So that is where that's the key ingredient, because we have all throughout the South, we have county schools, but Wake County stands out in that it does an economic mix, and that economic mix has been proven. You know, they started in 1976, and through the years, you look at their statistics, and their statistics for economically disadvantaged children are much better, significantly better, than anywhere else where county schools are really still segregated, because you could have a county school district. If we had a county school district right now, you'd still have Pittsford and you'd still have Rochester. Management alone isn't going to change anything. It's going to be the economic composition that's going to change things.
Yeah, and not to use the B word, Paul Hippolyte, but in Wake County, what they did was they said, we're going to create this barrier, no more than 40% free and reduced lunch or you know, some sort of economic. And to do that, we're going to put kids on buses. We're willing to do it because it's the right thing to do. And yes, for some kids, that means longer bus rides. And for others, it doesn't. It was the right thing to do. There's not a perfect system. Does that appeal to you?
In that case, it sounds like it works well. I think that, again, that's a stopgap measure, because the real issue is economic inequality. The real issue is class in this country. The real issue is housing policies and the ability for people of low income status to get a housing loan, for the ability for them to get credit, for the ability for them to all the tools for them to help provide for their family and climb their way out of poverty. That's really what we're dealing with. And right now it's concentrated in certain areas where you have to bust people out of them. That's a failure of the policies of our cities and our counties.
And not to keep coming, I'll come back to Bill in just a second, not to keep coming back to this one essay, but my goodness, that has echoes of the Nick Hanauer piece in The Atlantic recently, which is that we keep talking about, quote, fixing schools or doing all that, but really the economic inequality and the wage gap is the disease, and just about everything else is a symptom. Do you agree with that?
Yes. We're not fixing schools. That's not.
You got to fix poverty.
It's a complete misnomer. We're not fixing schools.
Okay, Bill Kella.
Yeah, for the most part, you're right, Paul. However, it really isn't a stopgap measure. If you look at what the history of what happened in Wake County, is that it had a tremendous economic effect, because what it did is that it converted schools. Where in this neighborhood there is this poor school, in this neighborhood, in this rich neighborhood, there is this good school. What happened is that all schools in Wake County turned out to be good schools. And as a result, the economy that people weren't afraid to be in, to develop in different neighborhoods, and businesses changed and decided where they're going to move their location. So it actually had a great economic stimulus. That's not to say I don't disagree with what you were saying, that schools are a reflection of the society. It's not the other way around for the most part, but it's an incredibly powerful impact when you look at making schools equal in a county. And it does have an economic impact.
Okay, now listeners,
and I wasn't disagreeing. Just for the record, I agree with that. So the studies that have been done from the short times that we have had integration, I believe there was a decade or two. There was a couple of researchers that I'm going to forget the name right now, but they were looking at a couple of like intergenerational or multigenerational effects of integration. And what they showed was that the kids, the grandkids, I mean, in terms of their test scores, their long-term prospects for employment and the amount of money they gained, everything was markedly better,
right,
because of integration, and that there was no downside for the white students that were also a part of the integration.
It was actually an upside.
Absolutely, yes.
It was a societal upside. And in front of me right now, which unfortunately listeners can't see, I have literally over 100 references that validate what Paul just said about improving academics, about improving civic and socioeconomic issues, or emotional issues and economic issues. It's actually good for the economy that we do this. And there are scores of studies that show this over the years.
Well, so a couple things here. Listeners, I'm starting to hear from you already in various platforms. If you want to call the program, I'd love to hear from you as we think about what integration means in schools and in our society going forward. And yeah, let's have this conversation now. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I've got listeners on Twitter. Shane is pointing to an article from the 1970s. Here's a case of white parents in Shalott throwing bricks, bottles, and rocks at black students trying to integrate Shalott High School in 1970. The instances in Rochester just in 1970 and in 1971, when this was, and I'm not a great student of history, I'm just trying to understand, was briefly attempted. There was tremendous white opposition on the way to more white flight to the suburbs. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what policy exists. I mean, how do you couple this with sort of an admission that this is the reality here, Bill? Because what Eamon referenced from Spencerport, we had an urban suburban program that has, is it a dozen kids a year? Maybe something like that. And no offense to Spencerport, but this was like a freak out, a public freak out.
I was on the panel.
You were there?
I was there. I was on the panel.
Is that a fair description of it? It was a public freak out of it.
It was a racial freak out.
Okay.
And on Twitter, I couldn't believe the kinds of responses I got on Twitter. It was frightening. It was a complete hate fest. And this is now. This is what's happening now. And I think we need to also look at it is the state of where we're at. I think if you look at our political landscape right now, it's really exposing an ugly underbelly. If you look at what we tried to do with a voluntary regional school, we had 120 people on 13 study groups from all over this county develop a voluntary regional school, and it doesn't exist today. We spent over a decade working on this with people like Tom Fry over the years, and it doesn't exist because of a lack of political will. Instead of saying, hey, I think this is the right thing to do, politicians have gone with decisions, especially in our case with the regional academy, of who's yelling in their ear the loudest at that given time, and I'm going to protect myself. And so we go on with the status quo, and we continue with the situation that we're facing today.
Well, Eamon, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I also want to introduce, because we haven't even talked about this yet, if we have integration at a higher level in this community, we also have to look at the perspective of the communities that we're breaking up and how does that affect them politically, your sense of identity. A lot of colleagues I've had and friends who went through the urban suburban program talk about the racism that they faced in those districts. And we have recent examples of the blowups in Pittsford and Brighton school districts around race. So there's no panacea here. There's no simple solution. You have to directly tackle issues of racism that are widespread in our community. We need to acknowledge that. And income inequality. And all of it in this conversation, we never really talk about how do we make the city school district a thriving center of learning, of economic opportunity, because none of these solutions get to the fact that we funnel the neediest kids into one district and we also create racially isolated districts. And this isn't unique to Rochester. This is true of Buffalo. They have the same demographic trends, the Syracuse, Batavia. I mean, you look across all the urban centers of upstate, and New York City has very segregated districts as well. This is the system. This is the reality. And we're not going in the other direction. So we don't need to just sort of spread people out. We also need to create great centers here. Why can't Rochester be a thriving district? And why can't, frankly, a majority student of color district be thriving? If Fairport can thrive with majority white students, why can't we have thriving majority student of color districts, and they do exist throughout this country. I'm not saying they don't exist, but
they exist in middle class neighborhoods.
Yes, right. Yes, and so you have to get to that root of the socioeconomic issues, and when we don't have the quick fix of the socioeconomic, some bridge opportunities. Why don't we have incentives to have some of the best teachers, administrators, and extra supports in those systems that are struggling? You need to have multiple strategies. I'm not proposing just do this one thing. You need to do all of these things in concert.
Well, even just one of those things takes political will.
Yeah.
And most of the things that you mentioned that you just mentioned exist in the regional academy, bringing high end teachers in and swapping teachers from the city and the suburbs. It all takes political will.
And if I can add one more thing to that, we have to also understand that this didn't happen by accident. This is not just the good people did the right thing and went to school and did not get in trouble, and this is they're reaping the rewards of being good people, which is we have this myth in the U.S. that you do hard, you work hard, and you play by the rules, and you're going to succeed, and it's a myth, and we need to just keep talking about this myth until we rid ourselves of it, because the truth is that the housing issue we're talking about when it comes to redlining, this was a government policy. This was post World War II, New Deal, around the New Deal era actually, when we had the FHA loans. They specifically would not give the 30-year mortgages to folks that were in these black or in these non-white neighborhoods, and specifically they were excluded from getting those long-term loans. And the loans that they were able to get, if they missed one or two payments, they would lose their houses. So this has to do with housing policy. This had to do with the access to credit. So this all created a system of economic segregation that we're still living with today. And so I know in the last time I was here, we didn't talk about it, but the question was thrown out about should reparations be something we're talking about right now. And there is a conversation of, okay, for communities that we know were specifically left out of economic progress, is there a responsibility for our government, for our communities to reinvest in those communities?
You want to answer that?
Absolutely.
The answer is yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That is, by the way, the Coates essay on reparations changed the national conversation, and this is probably 2 or 3 years old now, in ways that I think are profound, because for so long it was perceived to be just about slavery, but really it's about economic dispossession. It's worth rereading. I'm late for our only break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to take some of your phone calls. And I have an email from a listener asking, why not just say there is no more Rochester School District and give every suburban district a portion of it? That's the idea that I've heard for years called the pie slice idea. I have no idea what our guests think about that or what they think the impact would be. That's one thing that's been proposed over the years. The notion of a countywide school district, the reason I think you're going to have a hard time with political will, even harder than normal, that Bill Calla talks about, is in Wake County in 1976, my understanding was there was a county district and an urban district, and they merged them, two of them. Here there's 19 or 20. So it's a lot of possible political will to kind of get over. But we'll talk more about the solutions they see for where we are in 2019. Which is in many ways much worse than it was in the 1960s when these conversations were happening then. Let's get that break. We'll come back with Bill Calla, a former superintendent of multiple school districts and the co-founder of Joining Hearts and Hands. Paul Hippolyte is a political strategist. Eamon Scanlon, education and policy analyst for the Children's Agenda. And your voice is next. Coming up in our second hour, by some measures, the average cost of a wedding in Rochester, New York is still more than $30,000. That's despite an economy with big wage gaps. We're not here to judge what you spent on your wedding next hour. We are going to talk about trends and the different options that couples are pursuing as they get married and they think about money. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. One important point before we grab some of your phone calls. When I think about that, the Spencerport conversation, and I know Spencerport might feel singled out here, but that was the most recent when it came to urban-suburban. We heard from a number of people who said, look, I moved here by choice for a reason, because this was the kind of community I wanted. And you can't force people to live in districts where then they make a choice to live somewhere, and then you're going to change sort of the makeup of the community that they chose to live in. I heard that argument again and again. You heard it too out there, Bill?
Yes, I did.
What did you tell people when they made that argument to you?
We have a moral responsibility for the well-being of all of our children, not some of our children. So there, our moral responsibility goes beyond a provincial idea that this is my backyard and leave me alone. We have a societal responsibility, and that's something that that we can't take lightly.
Let me get some phone calls. Rich in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Rich.
You know what amazes me? Hi, Evan. Is that people don't realize that all the efforts it takes to keep these broken systems and these derelict systems in place hurts our economies, it hurts our country, it hurts us in so many ways. I don't understand why people don't understand if you have a school system, say a municipal school system of a county, where all your schools are good, everyone wins. Talking to the people from Spencerport, first, my first question to them is, what did you move out here for? Did you move out here to have good students in your school? If that's the case, most of your students who are going to be bused are students from conscientious parents who want their kids to get a good education. Or is it the racial mix-up? I mean, mix of the place that you moved. I mean, I think a lot of the times people say these things, and the question, those tough questions aren't asked. What did you move out here for? Did you just move out here to be, for lack of a better term, in an all-white, homogeneous situation, or did you move to have a healthy situation? And busing does not do any, does not hurt that. In fact, it probably enhances that.
So, Rich, the only dissent I have to that idea is I think people are more overt about it now, maybe especially since 2016, but I think more people would be willing to tell you, this is the community I moved out here for, and what it looks like, the racial makeup, the economic, the quality of life. Maybe there will be some denial that, oh, I don't care, you know, the racial makeup. I moved out here for the quality of the schools. But I think people are a little more overt about it these days.
And that's okay. Then you answer them. Then you call it what it is.
Yeah.
So you're a segregationist. That's what you ask them. Because that, if you tell me that you want an all-white school system, you're telling me you want segregation.
Yeah.
There's no way to subtly say that. Also, I'm not a fan of things like charter schools, because that's nothing but more stratification. We have to fix this system. It's got to be a holistic fix, mostly economic. How do you get the banks to start reinvesting in the city without it being a child from the white suburban family moving in? How do you get the banks to give the money to the people who have been in these neighborhoods forever? All these type of things. And the sad thing about it is the Northeast, which is supposed to be a bastion of integration, probably is the worst when it comes to redlining and keeping in place these systems, because no one was looking at them. And when Martin Luther King tried to look at them in the 60s, they turned against him. Look what happened in Chicago. A lot of the people in the Northeast turned against him. As long as he was straightening out that black problem down south, it was fine. So there's a lot of things to unpack here.
Yeah, Rich, I appreciate that. You're right. The Northeast of this country is more segregated in many ways. Our schools in this state more segregated than many southern states. I mean, that's just true.
In fact, New York State has the highest racial, in terms of black-white segregation in the country, New York State.
But are you hearing anything, Paul, that moves you off the idea that we have to start with the economy? I mean, I people want to, quote, fix schools. I could read a litany of tweets already of people how they want to fix schools. Are you hearing anything that moves you in a different direction in terms of how to better integrate?
Because the issue when you say, a lot of times when people talk about fixing schools, it's you're not dealing with the entirety of the problem. You're saying, like, we can isolate the kids, or we can isolate this program, or we can isolate a school board or whatever it is, and point to them and say, that's the problem. It's those adults, and not look holistically at all of the contributing factors as to why we have this concentrated poverty. One of the things I was researching before I got here was So you're talking about, I think earlier the gentleman was saying, are people, like, what kind of school are they going towards, or what kind of community are they looking for when they go to these suburbs? And they were, there was a story that was told by Cory Booker's family that went undercover to try to get into housing in a majority or all white suburb, and they had to go undercover. They tried to do it. The realtor wouldn't give them the housing. Said we're full now. Those houses are no longer for sale. And then they had a white family, I believe, went undercover and bought the house. And then when it was time for the sale, the realtor realized that it was his family. And I believe he said they punched him, the dad, in the face or something, and tried to sick his dogs on them. And then eventually, like, fell on his knees, like, begging them, like, please don't move into this neighborhood because I'm afraid for my business. And we were at a point in our country where if you had more than 10% of that neighborhood was black, not because they could have been doctors, lawyers, whatever. But if more than 10% of that neighborhood was black, then all their property values would go down, and they would lose their they would lose what they saw as their access to a stable middle class future. And so these fears, like, some of it is just our racial biases, and some of it is steeped in our actual economic policies as a country that we've created.
You can ask any African American, any person of color, for a story like that, and they will give you one. That it's pervasive. It truly is. So that is, in about 10 years ago in Fairport, I started a program called Embracing the Differences, where families of color teamed up with white families, and they had to meet once a month, and they just had to hang out and decide what kind of activity they were going to be involved in. And we had we'd have debriefing sessions every so often, and we'd hear stories like the one that Paul just related over and over again. So it's something that is not going away. And I would go back to, I want to recommend a book. It's Hope and Despair in the American City by Jerry Grant. And that book actually compares Syracuse to Wake County. And he gives the whole history of the redlining. And when you look at that book and you read it, and everything that happened in Syracuse happened in Rochester and happened in New York State. So it's a good history. It's a good example of how this has all happened, and how we ended up where we are today.
Okay, Eamon.
Yeah, and I want to introduce one more wrinkle into the conversation, because the demographics of our community and our state are changing, and we have to sort of reframe and think about what is the mission of public education. Who are we educating? New York State already has a majority non-white enrollment in K-12. So if the education system's not serving non-white students well, then we're not serving majority of our students. And in Monroe County, we will also cross that threshold pretty soon, probably in the next 10 years, maybe sooner. So it's not just a question of integration. It's also a question of how do we educate, and do we prioritize the education of students of color? Do we recognize who we are as a community? And so I want to leave it right there and get some other thoughts on that.
Boy, there's a lot of comments rolling in here. Sarah writes to us to say, we moved to East Irondequoit specifically because of how diverse that school district is. The comments I get sometimes make my blood boil. East Irondequoit versus West Irondequoit has an interesting history. Might be worth discussing on a future program. That's from Sarah. I appreciate the thoughts there. Sarah, back to your phone calls. Jim in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. Very interesting conversation. I want to highlight three things, basically, very quickly. First of all, America's original sin was slavery, and it hasn't been fully redeemed. It's been working on it. There have been improvements made, but we haven't been fully redeemed. Until that day comes, we're going to always have these problems. The second thing is, May 1962, in the Federal Third District Court here, Judge Burke declared that the Rochester City School District was de facto segregated. And at that time, the powers that be started to to grease the wheels, as they would say. They created the urban suburban program to allow people to have contact with people that look other, that look not like you, to understand that this thing had to open up. In fact, some of those people who were some of the original founders of urban suburban are still living, maybe 91, 95 years old, whatever the case. But that case really highlighted the problem that the Rochester City School District, and that goes back to the same problem that the new superintendent's going to face, because he's coming from the state of Virginia, which is where I'm from. There's a countywide system. Fairfax County is probably one of the most diverse districts in terms of demographics. I'm talking about global demographics, because of the walls that this country have been involved in the past 20 years. You have people from Iran, from Iraq, from Syria, from Lebanon, from Vietnam, well, South Vietnam at that time, from Kuwait, everywhere. So this gentleman is coming into a situation that's probably entirely different, because that was a 200,000 student school district, and it was four superintendents, assistant superintendents, and one superintendent. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this new gentleman comes up with a plan to help turn this thing around. But I want to make one more statement based on what one of your panelists said. Mm-hmm. There's no rhyme or reason why the city school district can't turn itself around with good leadership at the building level, and the superintendent, Dr. Keller, would know something about this. Turn itself around with parent involvement and with people engaging those students. Teachers, students can't teach themselves. They have to have good leadership at the building level and at the classroom level. And I want to say this, in the height of segregation, because when my dad built his home, we built it in a community, and we were next to a white school, and I got bused for 12 years. They had a gym, they had lights, a football field. In 1950, we played our basketball games outside in the wintertime, but anyway, that's another story. But I want to say this. Some of the greatest African-American leaders in this country have come from historical segregated black schools. And let me give you an example. There's one that's my all-time favorite. Daniel Chappie James went to Florida A&M University. He was one of the few people in the history of the United States Air Force. It was Army Air Corps originally, who had an ACE. That's when you shoot down four enemy aircraft during the era of the piston engine airplanes in World War II. The involvement of the jet planes when they came online in the Korean War and in Vietnam. And he became SINC of NORAD, Commander-in-Chief of the North American Air Defense Command. And them high-ranking brass at the Pentagon would ask him to come down to a meeting. He said, go out there and crank up my jet. He'll fly himself to Andrews Air Force Base. And he went to the Army Staff College east of Harrisburg, Fort Benjamin Harris, and that's where they take the best of the best. So it's no reason why this school district can't turn itself around and produce quality students like that young man that went to Madison, Wilson Magnet School, that just gave them kids at the prep school $1,000 each to help them in their ongoing college education, because he was from the city school district, had a very successful medical practice in terms of orthopedics.
Well, then, Jim, let me just jump in and let our guests respond to that. I mean, does that move you at all? I mean, what do you think, Paul?
It's a numbers game. So I grew up in Far Rockaway, Queens, and the school I went to, until high school when I moved to, when my parents moved to Ohio, I had no white friends. There were no white people in my school that I went to. Mostly immigrant, very, very poor. And it's a numbers game. Some people are going to get out, and most people are not. And so I get back to the same thing I was saying before, where it's not just the schools. It's everything around poverty. It's all the issues you're dealing with. And yes, you have some majority, and Queens is actually the only county in the United States where the black median income is higher than the white median income. And so you have neighborhoods. You have neighborhoods that are majority black, that are majority minority, that have what we would consider good schools and communities that are succeeding. But again, even in those neighborhoods, you have people that aren't doing well, but the majority are going to have a middle class existence. And so, there are kids that are going to do well in the city school district. There are plenty of kids doing well. But we have to understand that with this level of concentrated poverty, it's not just the schools, that the city is crumbling. There are neighborhoods that are crumbling. It's so much larger than the school system.
Yeah, and that's why we also need to talk about an equity framework in terms of where resources go, where kids go. I mean, you need to tackle the root of the problem, which is poverty and racism. So we can't just sort of glide over those two things. But keeping that in mind, we also, in the current context, do we have that equitable distribution of resources to target the kids that are most in need? And often that's not what happens. The communities that have the most resources concentrate and keep those resources. And the ones that are most impoverished do not have the best administrators, the best teachers. But I don't think that in itself would fix it. They could maybe get the graduation rate to 80%, or you could have some greater level of success. But on the margins, it still is a numbers game. And how do you actually have a system that educates every child? And I think that's what Paul's referencing.
To respond to the caller's one of his points, I do believe that you can make a difference with improved leadership and a better mechanism in the Rochester City Schools. I said you just had an 84-page report that pointed out a lot of things that are accurate. So I think that does make a difference. It's not going to make a big difference, unfortunately. It will make a positive difference, but it won't make a big difference. I think you have to, if you look at the annual report of the Children's Agenda, and you look at the information in that report, that is very telling. When you have a kindergartner who comes into a city school who has half of the vocabulary of a suburban counterpart, I think you have to look again at the root causes. And I think we won't belabor the point. The root causes are economic. And we have to look at those if we're going to address this problem.
All right. Patricia and Aurora, try to keep it to a minute or less. Keep it tight. Go ahead.
A minute or less?
I know. Okay. I know it's late. We could have done all day on this.
My first year teaching, I was in the Rochester City School District at Wilson Junior High School. And it was the first year of forced busing and reorganization, and it was an abomination. I was assaulted by a student, et cetera, et cetera. I transferred to another school, taught for 7 more years, and then I left. Fast forward to 1995, and I was a professor at Cornell University, and I was part of the pre-freshman summer program. And we took 75 students from the New York City inner city area who had done well in their high schools that didn't necessarily offer AP courses. So what we did is took them as pre-freshmen for 6 weeks and gave them a very stringent 6-week course on math and science, et cetera. And at the end, they were then full-fledged freshmen, not pre-freshmen. And we followed those kids all the way through college, and we had like a 98% graduation rate. So basically, by getting these kids who did work hard and did do well, and their parents probably didn't go to college, and they probably were from, well, I know they were from low socioeconomic areas, they did well, and they infiltrated with everybody there. Cornell's a very diverse campus, and these kids were superstars. So I just wanted to put in my 2 cents because my very first year teaching was the forced busing. Mm. And I saw one end, and then I saw the other. So I'd be glad to be on some panel or committee or something to be part of this because I was part of it.
Well, send us an email separately, Patricia. I appreciate that. Connections at WXXI.org. And in our last minute, Andrew writes to us and says, I'm sick of the no political will argument. I know it won't change overnight. Let's talk about the levers of power needed to shift that political will for county school integration, housing policy, et cetera. Paul, what's got to change?
So the having the conversation, I had this conversation last night with some friends who were talking about moving out of the city once they had kids. And myself, along with another friend, said, why would you do that? We need you here. As Booker T. Washington once said, cast down your buckets where you are. And we have families moving back. I have friends that moved back from the suburbs into the city. And we need to have this conversation. I know you had the Dr. King talked about the beloved community, and how we can get rid of hunger and homelessness and poverty. Like, we have the tools. Jeff Bezos' wife, I believe, just got $38 billion in their divorce. We are overflowing with money in this country. It's just, do we want to do it? Do we? And I think we can. It's just, we can't stop the conversation.
Eamon, you think we can do it?
Of course we can do it. It's a policy question, and we can build political will. Political will is not an it's something we can conquer.
And yes. Are you willing to be an optimist on this, Dr. Kawa?
I'm not sure. it's a tough position. I think we should have our politicians at the table with us, and we could face them in a Kamala Harris, Joe Biden moment.
Well, let's do it. Let's continue that conversation. We'll do it here. That's Dr. Bill Kawa. Thank you for the time, Bill. Always nice to see you.
You're welcome.
Eamon Scanlon from the Children's Agenda. Thank you, Eamon.
Thank you.
And political strategist Paul Hippolyte. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Short break. More connections coming up.